It's Jim, it's the World of Bonds, it's Thursday the 7th of March 2024. This is for professional investors only and never ever investment advice. Happy World Book Day to everybody. Looks like both my kids are going dressed as Adrian Mole to school today. Good effort, lads. Bad luck to those of you with primary school age kids who've been desperately rushing around trying to cobble up a Willy Wonka in 10 minutes before they have to go to school, having forgotten all about this accursed day. Looking at the headlines around the latest UK budget, which was delivered yesterday by Jeremy Hunt, there's very little excitement. There were, to use the cliche, no rabbits to be pulled from the Chancellor's hat. Although Jeremy Hunt did steal Labour's own rabbit, and in abolishing non-dom tax status, he spent the rabbit's proceeds elsewhere. So Labour have got a job to do trying to find some new ways of raising the revenue that they've promised to spend on stuff. There was a tax cut, came through a 2p cut to national insurance rates, but the overall tax take stays around its highest level since 1948. So just over 37% of UK GDP is effectively collected as tax, or an amount equivalent to 37% of GDP. The Office of Budget Responsibility and, of course, the Institute of Fiscal Studies have been all over the wires the last 24 hours. The OBR was on the BBC 4 Today programme this morning and claimed, well, asserted, there is no plan for the majority of the spending cuts implied in the Chancellor's numbers. Presumably, I guess, because the Chancellor doesn't really believe that it will be the Conservative Party's problem beyond the next year, where there is a firm cost-cutting plan. After that, it's just one big number, I think 20 billion or whatever it is. So that's Labour's problem, presumably after the next general election, if the polls stay as they are at the moment. The Office of Budget Responsibility also points out that the growth rate for the UK required to keep to the forecasts for borrowing and spending can only be achieved with an additional 1 million migrants to the UK. And that's really because we have a problem with sickness in the UK, with the existing domestic workforce. So in order to keep growth going, they'll need an additional 1 million migrants to the UK. And that will take the annual rate of immigration into the UK up from 290,000 per year to 350,000 per year. And I think that's the kind of key to the forecast from the Chancellor. The margins require some assumptions that, you know, immigration is going to rise by that much, and are very, very narrow as it is. So for the Chancellor to hit his number one fiscal target, that being to have debt to GDP for the UK falling in the fifth year of the forecast period, he only has around about £9 billion worth of wriggle room there, or 0.3% of GDP, which is really tiny in terms of the scale of what goes on and how many moving parts there are. And the other thing that the forecasts rely on is that the government unfreezes the fuel duty escalator and starts resuming hiking fuel duty, something it would be presumably quite find quite difficult to do, having frozen the fuel duty. Oh my goodness. So what does all this mean for gilts? Well, we're going to get probably an extra 30 billion of gilts in the 24-25 fiscal year, taking the total up to 265 billion of gilts. Net of redemptions and net of QE or QT, quantitative easing, quantitative tightening. Obviously, at the moment, it is moved from QE onto QT. That means nearly 160 billion of net issuance in the next fiscal year, 24-25. Remember, in fiscal year 21-22, we had effectively zero net issuance for gilts on that measure, net of redemptions and net of QE, QT, back in the day when there was QE. When it comes to the impact of this issuance on the gilt market and on the gilt market curve, RBC, the investment bank, points out that the skew is now for shorter dated issuance. So on the face of it, it looks like we're getting 3 billion fewer longs being issued and 3 billion more medium dated gilts being issued. And the impact of that is to reduce the average maturity of gilt issuance to a historic low of around about 12 years. Remember, the UK has the longest maturity stack of major bond markets, but that long duration liability portfolio for the UK government is starting to come down, in part due to a lower investor preference for ultra long dated gilts, and that's as a result of a shrinking defined benefit pension fund market as people move to buy out in that market and we get a roll off there, but also as new pension funds for new employees, and most employees in fact nowadays, they only offer DC, defined contribution, rather than DB. So demand is probably falling for those longer dated assets, and as a result of that, you should expect the UK's maturity profile to move shorter. But gilts have been on a good run in the past week or so. We opened this morning actually back below 4% at the 10-year gilt, although we are of course still 60 basis points higher than we were back at the lows of December, when yields just completely collapsed around the world in the last week or so of the year in low liquidity. Other couple of things quickly worth mentioning, really. Japan, if you look at the Japanese yen this morning, it's seeing a big rally. It's up around about 1% against the dollar. It's below 148, having been above 150 and a half just a couple of days ago. And this is basically as a result of some strong Japanese wage data and wage demands there. So, one demand that I'm seeing coming across the screens, 4.5% last year, nearly 6% this year. And Bank of Japan members are kind of talking about, I guess, the first moves away from negative interest rates and so forth. So big moves there in the Japanese yen as we get nearer what may well be this month's business for the Bank of Japan. MUFG, the Japanese bank, says it's probably going to be a March hike, although like the rest of the world, it may well get shifted back to June. Everyone else cutting in June, Bank of Japan hiking in June, but you know, don't rule out something this month. And then finally let's talk about tips and tipping. How do you think tips go into the inflation data? First, some news on tips. So pre-COVID, 15% tip was kind of standard for North America, US and Canada, perhaps a little bit higher in New York and places like that. Nowadays, 18% is probably the absolute minimum you can get without getting chased down the street afterwards. And sometimes it's more like 30% expected in some places. So a significant rise, perhaps even a doubling in some cases of the rate of tips. But does what you might call tipflation, and there's a good article if you Google, is tipflation even part of inflation, on econreporter.com? And the answer is no. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is the US department that looks after the CPI, in an email to Econ Reporter said, "I can confirm that tipping is not part of the CPI price collection process. Tipping is definitely not a part of the price change calculation process performed by CPI economists." So the reason for this is that the BLS says that tipping is an optional activity, and therefore the CPI only includes required payment, so it doesn't really get included. I think that, you know, as the article points out, that's a bit of a topic for debate, really. Is tipping, what would happen if you tip zero in a New York restaurant? You'd probably be found floating in the Hudson not long afterwards. So there is an argument that maybe tips should be included in inflation to reflect the fact that they have gone up quite substantially in the world after inflation, as have other kind of charges, optional food charge to reflect higher food costs of 4% in many restaurants in Chicago and New York, which is really, again, something you probably wouldn't argue with the waiter about including on your bill. So there we go. Perhaps tipflation is causing the CPI to be underestimated in the restaurant world. There is, though, the article goes on to point out, there are ways that it is captured, and that's really in the basket weights. So the basket weights look at consumption of stuff, and as tips will go into the total restaurant spending category, you'll see restaurant spending category increase as a share of the spending basket. So you will see the impact of tips in raise tipflation rather in ways raising the weighting of restaurants within the CPI basket, but it won't get captured directly in the prices that are reflected in that CPI basket. I hope that's clear. It's non-farm payroll week, so that's going to be the big one for markets this week. Let's have a quick look on Bloomberg and see what we're going for tomorrow. Can I get there in time to make it? Blah blah blah. Even that's the United Kingdom, that's no use to us. We don't have a non-farm payroll. Right, let's quickly have a look. Change in non-farm payrolls, 200,000 is what the market's going for. Last month, 353,000. So a big fall. Remember, upward surprises have generally been the order of the day. Final thing, New York Community Bancorp, remember that bank that got into big difficulties recently as a result of CRE, commercial real estate problems, that got a massive equity injection yesterday, a big bailout from private equity investors of over $1 billion. That sent its bonds rallying up about 20 points on the news. It's been trading as a distressed bond. NYCB had around 60% of its loan book in CRE, and this is regarded as therefore a very bullish development, not just for CRE, not just for NYCB, but also for the banking sector in general, that people have this confidence to put a large, $1 billion into a very distressed bank. That's it. Bye.